Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is adapting to climate change. With me to discuss the steps that policymakers, business leaders, and others need to take to address the changing climate is Alice Hill. Alice is the David M. Rubenstein Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council. A lawyer by trade, she held several positions in the Obama administration, including serving as Senior Director for Resilience Policy on the staff of the National Security Council, and also serving as Senior Counselor to the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, where she led the formulation of DHS's first ever climate adaptation plan. Alice's new book, The Fight for Climate Change After COVID-19, is just hitting bookstore bookshelves. Alice, congratulations on the publication of the book, and thanks for sitting down to chat with me.
Oh, thank you, Jim. Delighted to join you.
Alice, I thought we might start with the latest report by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which summarized the current scientific consensus on climate change. The picture the IPCC painted was grim. Things are worse than we thought and getting worse faster than we thought, so much so that UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the report presented a code red for humanity. Do you share that assessment?
Yes, it was a very important report. Of course, the IPCC, that group of scientists that are sanctioned by the countries of the world, 195 members, those scientists have been meeting since the 1990s to tell the world what's afoot with climate change. And this report was the clearest yet that we are in very serious trouble. The nations on the planet need to act quickly to reduce the emissions that have already accumulated, but also importantly, to start adapting to what can no longer be avoided in terms of sea level rise, wildfires, drought, extreme storms. We need to get busy.
Before we talk about mitigation and adaptation, Alice, could you just sketch out for us in brief, when we talk about climate change getting worse than it currently is, what's in store for us over what period of time?
Well, we have a lot of heating ahead, and with heating, there are impacts which can have a devastating effect on lives, livelihoods, and the global economy. So what we've seen since the industrial era is that humans, and by the way, the IPCC report was absolutely clear on this, it's unequivocal that humans are the primary cause of climate change. So emissions caused by human activity, the burning of fossil fuels, other activities have just been accumulating in the atmosphere. And when those emissions accumulate, they form a kind of blanket around the planet, which is a little like the blanket that we cover ourselves on a cold winter night. And we're pretty cool when we slip underneath that blanket. But over time, our body heats up the air underneath the blanket and we get a lot warmer. And that's essentially what's happening to the planet. Now, there's a delayed timing there, similar as with the blanket, as with the accumulation of carbon emissions and other emissions in the atmosphere. So even if we cut our emissions to zero tomorrow, which highly unlikely that would occur, we will still continue to warm. And that was a significant takeaway from this IPCC report, is that we are due for more extreme events happening faster, becoming bigger as a result of what we've already put in the atmosphere, much less what we're expected to put in the atmosphere in coming.
So the wildfires that we've seen in Australia, in the American far west, rising sea levels, more extreme weather, having temperatures top 120 degrees in Sicily, and I think in some places in British Columbia, that's going to become more common going forward?
Yes. So the extremes that we're experiencing today, we tend to think, oh, that's the worst it will get. No, wrong. It will get worse. So it's something to watch for as you're reading media reports or listening to media reports. You'll hear somebody say, you know, I've lived here 50 years and I've never seen anything like this before. Well, that's kind of what climate change brings. New, unfamiliar extremes that are highly damaging.
Okay, Alice, you've mentioned two critical words here, mitigation and adaptation. Mitigation, as I understand it, is about taking steps to reduce the emission of the heat-trapping gases that fuel climate change. But you've focused your work on adaptation or resilience, that is, on the steps we need to take to adjust to a changing climate. Why is that?
It's really really happenstance. My first assignment to deal with climate change was with President Obama, and he had issued his first order in late 2009 about how federal agencies should plan for climate change. I was the new person at DHS. No one on the senior team expressed any interest in working on climate change because it was considered a politically toxic topic. So in the tried and true tradition of bureaucracies, they said, oh, give it to her. I was the new kid. And that order contained two components, one to focus on cutting emissions and the other to focus on adaptation. At DHS, this huge sprawling security agency, we decided that cutting emissions piece really applied to our fleets of cars, planes, boats, and that was best run by our management team. But that left the adaptation piece for someone to pick up, and that became mine. It thrust me into a world where there were few thinking about this other side of the climate change coin, adaptation. So I've had the opportunity to see this field develop pretty much alongside my entry into the study of adaptation.
Now, it's no secret to you, Alice, that a lot of people who work on climate change don't like talking about adaptation. You and I have had this conversation before, so you know the arguments. People argue that if you're focused on adaptation, you're essentially conceding defeat at the outset. And I've heard people liken adaptation to putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound, but the changes that are coming will swamp the ability of wealthy countries to adapt, and poor countries won't have a chance at all. So how do you respond to the argument that we shouldn't be thinking about adaptation, we should be focusing on cutting emissions?
My first response is, of course, we need to cut emissions. The reason we have to cut emissions is to avoid the very worst of heating. My second comment is that we are already experiencing the heating, and we are seeing tremendous loss of life. Let's just take heat extremes. One of the most certain impacts of climate change are more heat waves that are hotter and last longer. And heat is the biggest killer of natural disasters. There are so many things we can do now to save lives during the heat waves that we are very confident are coming. So when you talk about doing mitigation or adaptation, I don't think it's an either or choice at all. I think we need to do both simultaneously so that we can save lives, but also keep our economies healthy by reducing the damage. If we reduce damage in advance, we can save, at a very conservative estimate, $6 for every $1 we spend in raising homes and keeping them out of the floodplain or keeping them out of areas that burn. If we make those types of investments, that means people get back on their feet faster, they can get back to work faster, and by the way, they will also have more money to continue to invest in this transition into green energy. So it just keeps us all healthier and keeps us stronger if we manage to both mitigate and adapt. And there are many people in this field, so there's a lot of room for a lot of work to be done.
Now, Alice, when you sat down to write your book, I note that you titled it The Fight for Climate Change After COVID-19. Why does COVID-19 show up in the title of a book about climate change?
COVID-19 has unfurled as the first catastrophic risk that everyone that's currently alive on the planet has experienced together. And there are lessons from that event that can easily be applied to improve the outcomes when it comes to preparing for climate impacts. I had the good fortune of working on both biological threats as well as climate adaptation. And as I watched the news, as I heard the reports of this first instance of a virus from Wuhan, I began to see the connections between my preparedness work for a pandemic or an aerosolized anthrax attack, as well as for wildfires and drought.
You also write that a major lesson coming from COVID-19 is the importance of leadership. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Leadership matters, and it matters for any catastrophic risk. It particularly has been shown during this pandemic that if our leaders fail to attend to the science, if they fail to act early and postpone and delay in the interest of politics, the costs climb very quickly to be really unsustainable. And that's what's happened with the pandemic. We had a president who was in place who said, I'll never forget, it's just one case from China. Anyone who's worked on pandemics knows that there are probably already many other cases that haven't been identified, particularly in a public health system that was previously starved for funding, but also that in a highly transmissible disease, you cannot have any confidence that it's just one person. And then if you do not make choices, assuming that it could get very bad very quickly, based on the modeling and the science that is readily available, you will fall short in keeping your country safe. Same thing is true with climate change. We have modeling and we have science that tells us of the dangers. We need leadership to get us to the new place we need to be, where we are seriously cutting emissions, but also very actively preparing.
I've been struck, Allison, in all of your writing and you're talking about resilience, that when you talk about leadership, you're not talking about leadership narrowly in terms of what it is that presidents and prime ministers do. You're really talking about leadership across society. And I note that you have focused in particular on business leaders, and you've written how the evidence shows that large numbers of business leaders haven't begun yet to contemplate what climate change might be for their business. And that's somewhat surprising, because you would think that if climate change has the ability to impact or hurt your bottom line in a business, you'd be very much focused on it. So talk to me a little bit about, from your experience, how business leaders are thinking about climate change.
Business leaders right now are across the map. We have certainly many promises that are coming forward of net zero, carbon free. That's exciting to hear. A footnote there, there is concern that that's greenwashing and that some of that might not turn out to be quite what is represented to be occurring.
Okay, so I have to ask you, Alice, what is greenwashing?
Greenwashing is like whitewashing. It's just that you're putting a green patina on your statements when they may not in fact be green. And that's what we found. Researchers have determined that if you look at some of the assets that companies claim are green, they're actually involved fossil fuel companies. When the European Union put in rules to start controlling better the representations about what companies are doing, $2 trillion worth of assets reportedly fell out from the consideration of being environmentally sound and having sustainability in governments, ESG components. So we need to watch that. But fundamentally, many leaders still do not understand what climate change will mean for their companies. And that's particularly true in the United States. One of the reasons is, I believe, because there's a significant lack of climate literacy among our leaders. This issue developed in the 90s. If you look at the age of many of our leaders today, they were already graduated from school by the 90s, and they haven't had any formal training in this. What they've learned about it is through media or other reports, and those reports have been highly politicized and contentious. The second thing that's holding us back is simply how the human brain assesses risk. When we think about catastrophic risk, we judge a risk based on our experience in the recent past or that of one of our loved ones. It's called recency bias. And so for us to imagine something so unfamiliar and believe that it will actually happen, we tend to think that won't be. We have to see it, feel it, taste it to really believe that this will be happening. I think there's been some revealing studies of the lack of preparedness of our boards, in particular among corporations, for these types of risks that are already present. There was one study done that looked at the Fortune 100 directors, 1,188 of them, looked at their publicly available CVs and resumes and determined that only 5% had any background that was identifiable in environmental issues. So that means that when those boardrooms, they close the doors and they have those frank discussions, you may not have any representative in the room that says, wait a minute, what does climate change mean for our supply chains, for our operations, in terms of shortages, transportation, communications, you name it, climate change affects everything? Are those questions being asked at the level they need to be asked to change behavior?
Well, Alice, let me draw you out on that point, and this idea of recency bias. surprise, that is, you tend not to prepare for things you're not familiar with. Can you just give us an example of how a business could have its bottom line affected by climate change?
Sure. It's happening right now. Let's just talk about supply chains. You know, supply chains have grown over time, very thin and reedy. They kind of cross all over the world. So you might have a part manufactured in one area, then it's shipped to another area, crosses a border, shipped to another area for assembly, and multiple parts like that. So as these chains become very thin, the links become vulnerable, and these impacts come in to break links, sometimes breaking multiple links at once, and then we have a shortage. Think about Puerto Rico, the island off of the United States. Turns out it was a major manufacturing center for certain pharmaceuticals, as well as saline solution bags. Those bags are used to deliver chemotherapy, nutrition, all sorts of things. You can't go into a hospital without seeing one of these bags tethered to some kind of mechanical arm to help patients. Well, when Puerto Rico lost power for a year after Hurricane Maria, manufacturing plummeted, the price of those bags jumped by 600%, and it became a shortage. Now, that's a critical supply, but no one had thought through. What happens if we lose this node that we need desperately to have public health, to have our hospitals perform, and to keep patients safe?
But it seems to me, Alice, as you talk about resilience, that we may tend to underestimate how difficult it will be to be resilient. You write that we need to prepare for concurrent, consecutive, and compounding disasters. You want to spell that out for us?
Yes, it used to be that, for example, our Federal Emergency Management Administration would be worrying about one type of event, hurricanes, or perhaps a wildfire. But now we have events happening at the same time, and they compound with one another, and then they cause cascading failures of infrastructure. So you can think of COVID-19 happening last year when we had 30 named storms in the Atlantic Basin. We had such large fires in California that Californians learned a new vocabulary word, gigafire, for a fire that burns more than 1 million acres. So we're seeing all at once events stress this emergency management system that we have built over generations beyond its capacity. In fact, a friend of mine at FEMA told me in a frank moment, you know, we just never imagined that we would have to respond to all 50 states and 6 territories at once. But that's the kind of thinking we need to do going forward so that we're ready for multiple events happening at once. And I'll just add that the risk here is that if we aren't prepared, then it slowly degrades communities over time, because as they try to come back, they can't get back to where they were before, and they begin to slide economically. People are in worse positions. Public health can decline. So we need to be at the ready.
Okay, so you see a future in which crises are going to interact, and they're going to compound the difficulty, and it's going to get worse if we don't take steps now to become more resilient to be able to handle what we can see coming down the road. But I'll note that another piece of advice you give is that we have to plan across borders. Just a little bit about what you mean by that. Then I have a follow-up question for you.
We need to focus on where these impacts will come. The impacts will not honor the borders that humans have so carefully crafted through the millennia. In fact, they're borderless disasters. I had never heard that term until I joined the Department of Homeland Security. And when we were talking about pandemics, it was flagged for me, this is a borderless disaster. So even if you shut your border, you might improve your results, but you cannot keep the disease from entering. When you're talking about climate impacts, those impacts just wash across whatever jurisdictional boundaries we have. And as we prepare, if communities don't account for what could happen to the adjoining or neighboring community, there could be some very unpleasant discoveries. An example of that would be building a dam to increase your access to fresh water, but not considering what happens to the community communities downstream. Building a seawall in front of your particular area, but where does all that water go if the adjoining communities do not have seawalls? It just washes over them. So in a new, profound way, we need to engage in regional cross-boundary planning to have better outcomes here.
So the borders here aren't simply between, let's say, the United States and Canada. It's between New Jersey and New York, or between towns and villages in New Jersey.
Absolutely. One of the surprising things is that we have tens of thousands of planning jurisdictions across the United States. So if each of those jurisdictions makes its own plan to keep safe from climate change, if they haven't coordinated with those that are in the same geographic area, it won't keep us safe. We need to find new ways to think across borders. And the pandemic showed us that if you just try to shut down, you're going to have people come into your community who are going to spread the disease. The reason we need cross-border planning is that we increase our vulnerability if we do not think about what the other impacts could be. And we could spend money in a way that we think will keep us safe, but actually will not keep us safe and ends up to be a waste of precious resources.
Now, you mentioned COVID-19 and what happened as countries tried to turn inward and close their borders. So I have to ask, is there anything about COVID-19 that gives you optimism that states are going to follow your advice about not being limited by borders, that they need to plan across borders?
I'm hoping that this is a better lesson for us. There is no particular instance where I thought we did a terrific job of planning across borders, but there were some highlights. When we had a ventilator shortage, some states came to the aid of others as they could look at the modeling and know that their state wouldn't be hurt as badly. And we're seeing that as we see another flare-up in COVID, that we are sharing personnel. We see it also in terms of wildfire fighting. We have Australians and New Zealanders coming to the United States to help us fight with our fires, just as we go to help them in their countries when they have terrible bushfires. And then we see the EU standing up firefighting efforts that will cover the entire area, because it recognizes that these threats cross borders and we need to help each other now.
Okay, another piece of advice you offer, Alice, is that we need to marry mitigation and adaptation. What do you mean by that?
We need to make sure that whenever we're making a choice about mitigation or a choice about adaptation, we think through, are these complementary or are they going to hurt one another or undercut our efforts? An example of this would be desalination. You know, desalination is often referenced as the savior because essentially what it does is it takes salt out of salt water and makes it fresh water. And we have a lot of coasts here in the United States. If we are having shortages of fresh water as a result of climate change, let's just embark on desalination. And that was something that we talked about in the White House when I was there. But that is a risky path if you don't think about what's going to power that desalination. Desalination requires huge amounts of energy. And if it's fossil fuel energy, that will contribute even further to the heating, which contributes to the shortage of water. So we need to make sure that if we're going to go down that path, we've thought about what kind of fuel is behind it, and also if there are environmental impacts, and there are significant environmental impacts, how can we mitigate those? So that's an example of what I call maladaptation. It could come at a significant cost to us in terms of our effort to cut and reduce the greenhouse gas emissions.
Now, of course, with COVID-19, we saw a lot of countries, particularly wealthy countries, open up the budgetary tap, spend a lot of money. Did we see governments use that as an opportunity to try to get ahead on mitigation and adaptation?
Unfortunately not. Much of the money that we have spent, the trillions that we have spent, has gone to not green investments, even green investments for better energy, but brown investments and continued support of the fossil fuel industry, which will lead to further emissions. This was an opportunity that is viewed as being missed. It's understandable, perhaps, why it was missed. We were in the midst of a crisis, but that's why planning is so important in terms of thinking through what types of investments would leave our nations in a better position when it comes to climate change.
Now, I suppose some people listening to our conversation, Alice, are wondering about why we haven't addressed the role of technology as a potential potential savior in terms of dealing with climate change. There's a lot of talk or speculation about geoengineering and how that might be able to save us from the predicament we're creating for ourselves. How does geoengineering fit into this conversation, or does it fit in at all?
Well, geoengineering has certainly climbed to a higher place on the agenda of solutions for climate change. Geoengineering, in very broad sense, has two components. One component is carbon capture and storage. That's where we take carbon out of the atmosphere and bury it or contain it somehow. And I think there is wide recognition that that probably will have to be part of our solution to reducing that accumulation of emissions in the atmosphere. It's called for by numerous authorities around the world, and we're seeing greater investments in it going forward. Unfortunately, it is not so far proven to be cost effective, given the prices that we have on carbon. And also, in some instances, it continues the use of fossil fuels. So there's some complicating factors there that will, I'm sure, be under consideration, but it's generally assumed that will be part of our solution set. The other geoengineering are efforts that are, for example, having planes take off daily and shoot particles throughout the atmosphere to deflect sunlight to keep us cooler. Those are much more controversial because there's concern about what those could mean in terms of destabilizing the climate, or, for example, if there were some disaster and those planes couldn't get up there, we could heat up very quickly, suddenly. So that is looked at a little bit from a distance, but we are seeing concern. Under the Trump administration, there was allocation of funds for the intelligence agencies to examine what other countries are doing with geoengineering. And by the way, geoengineering could occur just a billionaire gets interested and decides to do geoengineering. So that's an effort to monitor. And then we have greater calls for some kind of international solution or guidance for what's permissible with regard to geoengineering and some kind of clearance process, because you can imagine that a geoengineering experiment run amok could have dire consequences for millions, if not billions, of people across the globe.
Well, that takes us back to your lesson that we have to learn to plan across borders, both in terms of what we're going to choose to do, but also what we want to make sure that others don't do. And I think it's pretty reasonable to say that it can be very hard to get governments to agree on a number of these things, and particularly if you add in some wild card with a wealthy individual conducting experiments on their own, I suppose that makes things even harder. As you sort of look out to the future, Alice, I mean, you've been working on this issue for a while. The scientific evidence, climate change continues to mount. We see more and more extreme weather, yet we haven't seen a major change in political attitude here in the United States. I think in a lot of other countries as well. Again, as you noted, a number of countries spent a lot during COVID and they didn't use it to get more green. In some cases, they actually rolled back restrictions they had on carbon emissions and the like. So what sort of advice do you have sort of looking out at the U.S. government, not just Washington, but states and local municipalities about how they should be thinking about these issues?
My call to action is for us to all get engaged. Our polling shows that, for example, most Americans, even young Americans, don't spend a lot of time talking about this issue with their friends, their families, and they are not involved in this in a way that will change minds. This is a matter for political leadership, and political leadership needs to understand what's at stake. So that requires each of us to become more engaged and work hard. I will say that I'm a little bit of an exception to this. I talk about climate change so much that my family has put me on a timer, and I can only speak for 5 minutes at a time. But for others who are not as passionate as I am, I urge them to put this as a priority. It's not going away. These are permanent, irreversible changes that we've already embarked on. But if we want to really accomplish the reduction of risk, we all need to be in this game. It's an all hands on deck problem, and it's going to require us all to rethink how we do business and what we focus on, at least in this near term, as we are, as one friend said, building the plane as we're flying it. We're trying to cut the emissions, adapt, and then also understand what's ahead so we're better prepared.
Well, a lot of what we've been discussing so far, Alice, probably falls under the heading of grim. The trends in climate change are grim. We've talked about the political dynamics, and they have been grim. I'd rather not end our conversation on a grim note. As you look out, do you see initiatives, maybe at the state level, regional level, where we're actually seeing some real progress? And again, the examples could be from here in the United States or overseas. But are there examples worth emulating in terms of producing the kind of adaptation and increasing resilience and combining with smart mitigation?
Yes. One of the remarkable things about adaptation is that, first of all, although humans have always been adapting, we've never had to adapt like this to unfamiliar risks. And secondly, because the adaptation occurs locally, we think we can't learn from each other. But if you step back, it turns out there are lots of lessons to be learned. So take Bangladesh. Bangladesh is one of the most threatened by sea level rise, as well as just flooding along its rivers. It just has a latticework of rivers across the nation. It's about the size of Iowa, 160 million people there. But they started to think seriously about how can we have better outcomes with flooding. They have created floating schools so their kids can remain in school during an extreme event. They have done a massive campaign to cut out the risk of cholera, which of course is spread, disease is spread during flood in the floodwaters. And they have educated their public about the need to only use bottled water, how to purify water, and how to use a sari, for example, to pour the water through, and that will eliminate a lot of the bacteria. And then they've started the hard work of thinking, okay, we're going to lose some land as the sea levels rise. Where will people go? They've chosen to start identifying cities where people can relocate, help those cities be prepared, and help the people be prepared to make the move. That's a really wise way to think about this. Otherwise, you have what, for example, happened here in the United States when we had the campfire. We had overnight 20,000 people rush into Chico, California, a mid to small sized city, and all of a sudden the kindergartens are full. There's no more affordable housing. Traffic jams. And everyone wants to be welcoming to migrants, but the reality is our infrastructure isn't ready for it, and we need to think about where migrants would go and how we can help them succeed in their new communities and how this could also be a win for the receiving communities. That's what Bangladesh is doing. We can all learn from each other because none of us have ever done this before.
But there's still a lot of work to do.
I think that's a fair statement. We're just at the beginning of our adaptation journey. Just at the beginning.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Alice Hill, the David M. Rubenstein Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council. Alice's new book, The Fight for Climate Change After COVID-19, has just hit bookstore bookshelves. Alice, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. What a pleasure.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.